How many of you have ever seen the game, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Has anyone ever seen that? Are You Smarter? Now, don't be ashamed. Leave your hands. I want to see how many have actually seen that show. All right. And how many of you were smarter than a fifth grader? No, you don't have to answer that question. Because when I took the little quiz, I'll tell you, it was embarrassing. But there was this game show that was on TV for quite some time called Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? And what they would do is they would challenge adults with questions that came from the fifth grade level. So they're ones that we should have learned somewhere in our elementary school years, but may not have. Anyways, they get them up there and they answer these questions and they earn money by answering these fifth grade level questions. So I brought a few of them in this morning, and we'll just kind of see how smart you are this morning. Like, what do you really know? I mean, do you know these details and these facts? So here's our first question. This one has to do with U.S. representatives. How long is the normal term for a U.S. representative? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years? Don't answer out loud, but think of it in your mind. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? The answer? 2 years. 2 years. How many of you got it? All right, half. Half. All right, here's the next one. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? This has to do with a heptagon. A heptagon is a shape with how many sides? Does it have 6 sides, 7 sides, 9 sides, or 14 sides? Do you have your answer? Is it your final answer? Are you smarter than a fifth grader? All right, a heptagon has 7 sides. 7. Okay, we've got 3 that got that one. All right, good. All right, here's another one. What is the fastest bird on foot? Some of you are wondering, what is an emu? A turkey, an ostrich, or a penguin? Please, if you're smarter than a fifth grader, do not guess penguin. All right, not penguin. The answer is, do you have it? Ostrich. Yes, ostrich. Just a couple more to test your knowledge. How deep does your knowledge go? Are you smarter than a fifth grader? Which of the following is not part of the Four Corners? We should know this one because we're part of this area. Arizona, Utah, Colorado, or Nevada? Do you have it? Which one is not part of the Four Corners? It's not Nevada. Not Nevada. It's New Mexico, actually, is the right answer. How many of you got that one? 7 people smarter than a fifth grader. Okay, we got that one. All right, here's another one. In the Northern Hemisphere, when is the autumnal, I don't even know how to say the word, the autumnal equinox? September, July, October, or March? I'm thinking autumn because autumnal, autumn. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? Did you guess September? How many of you? Yes, half. All right. All right, how about this one? What is the lowest prime number? For all of our mathematicians in here, lowest prime number, 1, 2, 3, or 5? Lowest prime number, 1, 2, 3, or 5? And the answer is 2. How many smarter than it? Oh, man, this is getting rough here. Last one, here it is. A turtle is classified as what? Supposedly fifth graders know this. Amphibian, fish, mammal, or reptile? A turtle is classified as what? Are you smarter than a fifth grader? The answer, turtle, is a reptile. How many of you got it? Reptile. All right, we end on a positive note. We mostly got that one. You know, I took this 20-question quiz on Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader and didn't do too well. I'm not going to tell you which ones I missed, but it was a little rough. You know, when I think about what fifth graders know, or when I think about what adults know, or when I think about what all of us in this room know all together, we don't know near as much as what God knows, because God knows all things. And I think what we find in this passage this morning is that God's knowledge is deep and it's intimate and it's vast and it's specific. I mean, think about some of the depths of God's knowledge this morning. Sometimes I'm calling all of my kids. I have 4 kids. I'm going to call them. I'm like, Elijah, need anything? What? You know, you mess up their names, you know, and I've only got 4 kids. Let's see, I got Kana and Lydia, right? I mean, 4 of them. Any of you parents with a bunch of kids, you know, you're like trying to rapid fire them and you're blending them together and mixing them up. And I mean, I can't remember 4 names, but do you know that God knows the names of billions of stars in the heavens? I mean, think about the knowledge of God. It says in Psalm 147:4, he determines the number of stars, We haven't even been able to count them. He determines the number of stars, so he knows how many there are, and he gives to all of them their names, it says in Psalm 147. He has a name for each one of those stars. I mean, we've tried to name some of them, right? We've tried to count them, but we can't keep it all straight. We can't extend how far they go. But God knows all those things. His knowledge is so vast. It's so specific. Do you realize this morning that God knows the number of hairs on your head? I mean, his knowledge goes that deep. I used to be a teacher. I taught high school science for 2.5 years when I was going to grad school. I was a part-time science teacher. And one of my favorite things to do in the science class was to bring in an electrostatic generator. Do you know what those are? Anybody remember those from science class? It's this big like metal globe, you know, and you plug it in, and it makes all the static electricity on it. And that's the thing where you put your hand close, and it makes those little shock things that come out. Or if you put your hand on it, what happens? You remember? Yeah, your hair goes crazy. Remember that? You did it in science class. I mean, your hair goes frizzing out all over the place, and we'd have these students come up and put their hands on it and take pictures of them with their hair all puffed out like this. But imagine trying to count that. I mean, how many are there? Well, some of us, you know, we've bicked it for a while, so we're okay. But I mean, what if you've got a big head of hair and all this hair is flying out this way? Imagine trying to count that. God knows the number of hairs on your head. It says that in Matthew 10:30. It says, even the hairs on your head are all numbered by God. Just think about how vast his knowledge is. He knows the stars by name. Think about how specific his knowledge is. He knows even the number of hairs on your head. He knows minor things, things that we wouldn't even think about. So imagine a woman, she's a grandmother this morning, and she wants to buy her grandchild a birthday gift. And so she decides on a pet. Now, grandmothers can get away with this, but most people can't, you know, just a surprise pet. And so she decides she's going to go to PetSmart and get a pet for her granddaughter for her birthday. And so she pulls in and goes inside, and she looks at the dogs and the cats. She said, no, my son-in-law won't like those. And so she decides something smaller, maybe a hermit crab, perhaps one of these little fish, or maybe a couple birds. She settles on the birds because they have a special. You buy one bird for $12.99 and you get another one for free. And then they'll throw in this little tiny cage for $29.99. And so she buys the whole packet. I mean, she walks out of the store carrying this cage with two birds in it, not knowing what she's going to do with it, but she knows her granddaughter's going to be surprised. And so will her son-in-law. She sticks it in the back of her car. She gets in her car, takes off out of the parking lot. But as she comes to the first intersection, a guy goes through a red light, and she has to slam on her brakes. She slams on her brakes, and the birds in the back seat come flying forward and fall on the floor. They're squawking around. And in that moment, do you know that God knew about those birds? I mean, it says it. It's in Matthew chapter 10, again, verse 29. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father. I mean, some of these things that we don't even think about, or maybe we don't even care about, God knows. I mean, he knows the stars, he knows the hair on your head, and he knows when a bird falls on the ground. He knows everything. Beyond all of that, I mean, beyond stars and the hair on your head and birds that fall to the ground, God knows you. And I think that's what the psalmist really wants us to feel this morning. And the reason I said the word feel is because I think probably all of us know that God knows, but we don't always feel like God knows. I mean, think about the trials of your life, or think about some of the secrets of your life, or think about some of the things that keep you awake at night, or think about the things that you feel like no one else understands. Friend, God knows you. And he knows you intimately this morning. I think the psalmist just wants to impress that on us as we look at these opening verses. It says in verse number 1, Lord, you have searched me. You've known me. You know when I sit down. You know when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down. You're acquainted with all my ways. God knows us intimately. Do you realize this morning that God knows everything you do? I mean, I think that's what you see in verses 2 and 3. He knows when you sit down, he knows when you rise up. He knows everything you do. And for some of us, I mean, you just have to pause for a moment. That means he knows what you do when your boss doesn't show up for work on time, or when your boss is on vacation, or he knows what you do when the professor steps out of the room. He knows what you do when you're with your friends. He knows what you do on Friday nights. He knows what you do. He knows you intimately. God knows what you do for pleasure, and he knows what you do for leisure. He knows the secret crimes you've committed or the hidden sins that you have not forsaken. He knows everything we do. I mean, that's what it means here. You've searched me. You know me. You know everything from when I sit down to when I rise up and everything in between. You know what I do. I can remember sitting in my office when I was pastoring in Maryland. There were these parents. They came in. And it was like Captain and Mrs. Ignorant, that's what we could call them, because they had no idea what was going on with their kids. Have you ever met a parent like that? I mean, everyone else knows what's going on, but the parents don't know. And they sat down and they were just grieved because they couldn't imagine this happening. Their son was not going to be accepted to a private college, and the reason he wasn't going to be accepted is because he had just been arrested. And why was he arrested? Because he was in downtown Baltimore and he was caught buying drugs. And they couldn't even believe it. Like, I don't even understand it. I mean, our good boy, I mean, I never even knew. I mean, that was kind of the line. I never knew. But my friends, God knows. I mean, I think part of the thing that the psalmist wants to impress upon us is even if we as parents don't know what our kids are doing, kids, let me tell you something, God knows. Or even if your friends don't know what you're doing, God knows. God knows what we do. He knows when you cheat on a test or when you cheat on your taxes. I mean, I think about a college lecture hall. It was Physics 1 at University of Maryland. There's probably 300 or 400 of us in this lecture hall. And the professor there, I don't think he really cared. He would hand out the test. He would have these two proctors that wouldn't get up and walk around. They would just kind of sit in the front. And he would just, like, I don't know what he did, but he was, like, looking over books or papers in front. He wouldn't even look up. I remember sitting in this lecture hall of 300-plus students for Physics 1, and I had friends that didn't show up for lecture, like, the entire semester. They showed up for tests, and then they had answer keys that were sitting on the floor because no one would walk around. They cheated their entire way through that class. Here I am, like, struggling along just to pass Physics 1, and my friend over here is cheating his whole way, and he didn't show up for any of the classes. How can they get away with that? My friends, they don't, do they? Because there's someone who knows. I mean, it might be a negligent professor up front, but we don't have a negligent God. I mean, he sees all of these things. God knows what we do. And I think if he knows what we do, he also knows what we don't do, right? I mean, he knows not just what we commit, but what we omit. And God looks at our lives, and he knows our rising up and our sitting down. He knows what we do. He also knows what we think. I mean, if you think about God being this personal God who knows us intimately, he's not just aware of the things we do, but he's also aware of the things we think. Look at verse number 2. It says, "You discern my thoughts from afar." Literally, he knows what you think. If there's one area of our life that we feel like is hidden and personal and private, it's right here. It's what goes on up here because people can't see it and they don't know it. And this is kind of our private space. It's what I think about people when I'm mad at them. It's what I think about saying to people if I could. It's what I think about yelling when someone cuts me off on the highway. It's what I wish I could say to my boss because he's such a... It's what, right? All these things are private and they're up here. If I could yell back at my parents, this is what I'd say. If I could, and all this resides up here. If I could just have my private pleasures and passions. If I could just covet and think of things I want. It all happens right up here. And we think it's our private space. But it's not, because here in this passage it says, "You discern my thoughts from afar." He knows what we think. He knows all of our inner desires. He knows all of our motivations. He knows not just what we do, but why we do it. He knows why you need 200 unblocked channels of DirecTV. He knows why you need it. He knows, teenager, why you want a smartphone. Is it really so that your parents can reach you? Is that really why? He knows why. He knows. He knows why you want to hang out with that group of friends. He knows all the things in our hearts, our desires, our wants, our thoughts, all the things that happen inside. In Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 3, it says this, "But you, O Lord, know me. You see me, and you test my heart." I mean, think about a God this morning who not only sees everything you do, but he knows all of the whys behind it. He knows all of your thoughts that go on up here and all of your passions, all of your desires. He knows those things. I can remember as a child, probably the things that filled my mind most were thoughts of covetousness. I wanted things. I grew up very poor and we didn't have much, but I wanted much. As a child, I remember it was at Thanksgiving. We would go to my grandmother's house and she would give us the catalogs, the Christmas catalogs that came in. She would give us the Christmas catalogs and we would flip through those and I would spend hours thinking about all the things I wanted. Like they occupied my mind. I thought about a boombox. Do you remember those? Like two tape decks and a record player on top, and I thought that would be the coolest thing. And even the detachable speakers. Do you remember those? I mean, I thought about getting this or getting that, or what if I had Bugle Boy pants? I mean, those would be the greatest. Bugle Boys, if only. You know, I wanted all that stuff's happening up here. People didn't know about all the covetousness in my heart and in my mind, but God did, right? Because he knows not just what we do, but he knows our thoughts. He knows our emotions. He knows what we crave, what we long for, what we lust for, what we covet. He knows all of those things. He knows what our heart is like whether we're happy or we're angry. I mean, there's people who are angry and irritated and they smile their whole way through it. "Oh yeah, honey, I'm doing great. Having a great day." Right? I mean, all that's happening right up here. But God knows those things. He knows whether we're bitter or we're envious or we're discontent or fearful. "Hey, how you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing fine." "Are you really?" Because God knows. Maybe you're filled with anxiety, but you don't let anybody know. Or you're filled with worry and preoccupations of fearfulness, but nobody knows except God. God knows what we do. He knows what we think. He knows what we say. I mean, think about it. God knows us very, very intimately. He knows what we do, what we think, and what we say. Notice the passage here. It talks about our tongue. Verse number 4. "Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether." He knows exactly what you say. And he actually knows it before it proceeds out of your mouth. I mean, before it's even vocalized. Have you ever thought to yourself, if I could go back, this is what I'd say. And you think those words in your mind? Or maybe someone's attacking you verbally and the whole time you're thinking about what you wish you could say back to them. All those words, who knows those things? They haven't come out of your mouth yet, but God knows them. All those frustrations. I was doing some drywall about a week and a half ago, putting up some drywall, and I was coming around this section where there was a corner, and I was holding the screw and trying to drive this thing in, and there was some corner bead underneath that I was having trouble getting the screw to go through, and I just leaned into this thing with my drill, just leaned into it and torqued it, and it slipped off of the screw and went right into my finger, and I punched the drill bit right through my finger, just one of those like, bam, and you just pull it out like this, and you're like, oh, and you know, like things, like if I wasn't a Christian, like things, you know, like all those things. Do you know that God knows every one of those things? Like, I didn't scream any words I shouldn't scream, and I didn't yell any things I shouldn't yell. But even if they formed in my mind, do you know who knew them? God. I mean, I just want you to feel the weight. I'm kind of stalling here on these things, and we're drilling into these things because I want you to feel the weight of a God who knows you intimately. Like he knows you more than anybody else knows you. He knows you deeply. He knows everything you do. He knows everything you think. He knows everything you say. There's no muffling. There's no whispering with God. How many of you have ever had jury duty? You know, where you make big money, 15 bucks a day, jury duty. No one here has had jury duty? Okay, six people of us have had the wonderful opportunity to do our civic duty and be jurors. And you're sitting there in the bench, and the judge calls the two lawyers up to the two attorneys up to the bench, and he flips this switch. I don't know if you had this experience or not, but he has an ability to flip a switch. And what it does is it uses a speaker system overhead to pump down white noise. Has anybody experienced this? This was my last jury duty, and it was like this shh sound, like this in the courtroom. And he did that so that he could muffle the sound of the two that were at his bench so he could talk to them without everybody else in the room hearing him. I thought, that's kind of a cool device. I mean, he could just kill that noise right there. No one can hear what's being said up in front. But I thought about that. You know what? There's no muffling devices. There's no white noise that blocks out God's ear. He hears every word you've said, every gossip that you've whispered to someone. Like maybe this week there's someone you didn't like and you talked about how bad they were and how they wronged you and what you didn't like, and you whispered those things of gossip. He heard it. Or backbiting or slander, or you demeaned somebody, or you had harsh teasing or angry words, or you demeaned or degraded someone with a sharp tongue, or maybe you lied or exaggerated this week. Do you know who heard those? God. God hears every word. Even before the word comes to your tongue, God knows it fully. Perhaps you've cursed this week, or you've blasphemed or used his name in vain. God hears those things. And why? It's because he's a God who knows us intimately. A theologian wrote this about God's knowledge. He wrote this: "My God knows all things. He knows them exhaustively. He knows everything, everything possible and everything actual. He knows all events and all creatures of the past, of the present, and the future. He's perfectly acquainted with every detail in life and every being in heaven, in earth, and in hell. Nothing escapes his notice. Nothing can be hidden from him. Nothing is forgotten by him. He never errs. He never changes. He never overlooks anything. God never learns from anyone because he knows all things. God knows things instantly and effortlessly, all matters and all matter. He knows every law, all relations, all causes, all thoughts, all mysteries, all enigmas, all feelings, all desires. He knows every unuttered secret. He knows all thrones, dominions, all personalities, all things visible and invisible in heaven and on earth. He knows all things in motion, in space, in time, in life, in death, in good and evil. God knows all things perfectly." Listen to this one. "God knows no thing better than anything else." Think about that. Why? Well, because he knows all things perfectly. He knows all things equally well. He never discovers anything. He's never surprised. He's never amazed. He never wonders. He knows all. And in the midst of knowing all, he knows you. He knows you intimately. What you do, what you think, what you say. That's what the psalmist is communicating here. Notice verse 5. "You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me." Now I want to pause for a moment. This knowledge, this fact that God knows you, it's kind of like it surrounds you. It's kind of like God is circling you about and he has his hand over top of you. And God knows you deeply and intimately and thoroughly. Now, how does that make you feel this morning? Right, God who really knows you, how does that make you feel? Because for some people, that's a deep comfort, isn't it? Like, oh man, God knows. I mean, he knows that I'm struggling this morning, and hurting this morning, and he knows I've been wronged this week, and he knows I'm in pain this morning, and he knows I feel lonely this morning. God knows these things. And for some of us this morning, it's a great comfort. But for others of us, it's actually a great conviction. God knows. I mean, he knows this week. He knows what you thought and what you said and what you did. And instead of welling up in comfort, you're actually welled up in conviction because God knows. I mean, this truth about God, it either helps us or it haunts us, doesn't it? I'm going to tell you, this passage right here, I told you earlier in the service, I said this passage was a special passage for me. And it's because many years ago in my Christian life, I was really battling sin, some deep-rooted sin in my life, secret sin, private sin in my life, sin that I didn't want anyone else to know about in my life. And the Lord really brought deep conviction on my heart. And this is the passage he used in my life to really root out sin. I mean, he rooted out sin with this passage. And I can remember I memorized this whole chapter. At one point in my life, I could have quoted it to you. And I memorized it because it convicted me deeply. But when I got rid of that sin, it also comforted me deeply. I mean, this was one of the greatest helps to me in my spiritual life because God knew me. It meant he knew what I needed and he knew what I was pained by and he knew what satisfied me and he knew everything. And I'm going to tell you, this will help you out of sin or it will haunt you while you're in sin. Because you'll never be able to leave here. You'll leave here and maybe you're going to continue in whatever it is that you're in, but you'll know this morning that God knows. Like it won't be a secret anymore. You'll know that whatever it is that you flip on the TV or whatever it is that you surf on the internet or whatever it is that you whisper to somebody else or whatever it is that you exaggerate or whatever it is that you, and fill in the blank, you'll know that God knows. God knows. There's no hiding. And this passage right here, it was a help and it was a haunt to me. But God used it in my life to root out sin and then to comfort me. And I just want to challenge you that this passage right here needs to be something that when you think about God knowing you, let it be a hem of protection and a hedge of comfort to you. Respond like the psalmist in verse 6 where he says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. You see, when you're walking with God, the fact that he knows you is a wonderful thing. It's one of the most comforting truths about God. You're walking with someone who really knows you. I just want to say this about the human life. That is, there's something about all of us that I know, and that is that we long to be known. We're terrified of it, but we long to be known. I mean, we just wish there was someone in our life who really knew us. Someone who knew us deeply. Someone who knew us exhaustively. We long for that. Listen, that's why all these love movies are made. That's why all these novels of romance are made. They're made about love ideas, people that endure the risk and the reward of knowing and being known. All of us long to be known and to be loved. But we're terrified of it because we're fearful that if I am known, then what? Then I won't be loved. Because there are things about us that none of us really like or we're all ashamed of or we wish we could redo. I want to tell you something. There is a God who knows you intimately and loves you deeply. There's nothing you've done that surprises God. There's nothing you've committed that can push you away from his love. He loves you deeply and knows you exhaustively. What your heart longs for can really only be fulfilled by this sort of a God, a God who knows you intimately. And so the psalmist is settled in that in verses 1 through 6, that there is a very personal God who knows us intimately. But it doesn't stop there. Not only does he know us intimately, but the psalm goes on and it says that God goes with us incessantly. It's like where we go, God goes. He's always with us. There's no lapse in time when, oh, he's lagging behind somewhere or he's forgotten us or left us alone. No, he never leaves us. He never forsakes us. He's always with us. Notice how the psalmist plays this out in verses 7 through 12. Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. What's he saying in that verse? I mean, think of the highest thing that he knew. I mean, the highest possible point that he could even imagine was heaven.
And think about the lowest possible point. I mean, the deepest possible hole. It's hell. I mean, if I would go to the highest point or go to the lowest point, you're there. Notice how he goes on. If I take the wings of morning or dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand leads me. Think about being in Jerusalem. Think about being in Palestine. The wings of morning. The sun rises in the east and it sets in the west, right? If I take the wings of morning, if I go to where the furthest eastern point is, where the morning is, or the sea, what sea is to the west? The Mediterranean. I mean, if I go to the sea, or if I go to where the sun comes, if I go to the two farthest poles that I even know about, even there, you're with me. There, your right hand leads me. There, you hold me. God is everywhere. He's with you incessantly. There's nowhere you can escape. Some of us have heard the phrase, you can run, but you can't hide. You can run, but you can't hide. Let me tell you this. When it comes to God, you can't run and you can't hide. But you can't do either one. Why? Well, because he's everywhere. You can't run, you can't hide. I mean, we have some evidences of this, some stories that play out in the scriptures, don't we? Of people who tried to run, people who tried to hide. How did that work for them? I mean, all of a sudden you're thinking of people like Jonah, right? Oh, I know. I'm going to run from God. I'm going to get on a boat and go in the opposite direction of where God wants me to go. Nope, God's there too. Or maybe you're thinking about Achan. He was going to steal some things and he was going to hide it by burying these treasures in the bottom of his tent, in the earth underneath his tent. Nope, he can't hide from God there either, can he? You can't go to the sea and you can't go to the depths because you can't hide from God. He's everywhere. Remember from the very first pages of Scripture, there were people that tried to run and hide? I mean, they sinned, and so suddenly they're hiding behind bushes and shrubbery. And that's how all the coloring pictures for junior church are. They got the people hiding behind the shrubbery, you know? And it's a good thing. Well, at least for the junior church pictures it is, but not in the real story. I mean, them running and them hiding, they were trying to get away from God. But there's nowhere you can run and there's nowhere you can hide from a God who goes with you incessantly. He's always there. I have three daughters. One of my daughters, when she was young and would get in trouble, she had this routine. So she's doing something that's wrong. I say, don't do that. She still does it. I say, all right, go to your room for a timeout. She would run to her room. She'd sit in the middle of the room, grab a blanket off of her bed and throw it over the top of her and hide right there in the middle of the floor. This big lump underneath the bed covers, you know, I mean, that's where she'd hide. Do you realize that's how ridiculous it is for us to think that we're hiding from God? It's like going to the center of the room and throwing a blanket over your head. Can you really hide from a God who goes with you everywhere? Can you really run from a God like that? The passage here says there's no distance that can separate you from God. That's verses 8 through 10. Go to heaven or go to the depths of hell. Go to the east or go to the west. There's no distance that can separate you from God. You can't climb higher than God. You can't descend deeper than God. There's no place where you can run from God. There's no distance that separates you. Notice what he says further in verses 11 and 12. There's no darkness that can hide you. In verse 11, if I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light be about me like night. No, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. Have you ever thought about what happens at night? I mean, it is funny. Like the sun sets and all of a sudden crime increases. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, we go to bed at night. Someone comes into our yard inside of our fence, and John Moon had his bike with a U-lock on his bike wrapped around one of our metal fence posts. So middle of the night, someone comes in because it's dark. Someone forgot to turn on the motion sensor light, so it was really dark. They walk inside, and they try to take the bolts off of the post so that they can lift the bike right off of the post. They got three of them, three out of the four off, bent the thing back, but they couldn't get it. They were hiding in the shadows of night because they think that the darkness covers them. But let me tell you something. The darkness is like light with God. God sees straight through it. There is no darkness. Do you want to know when internet sites, the internet sites that you shouldn't be logging onto, do you want to know when traffic rises for those? I mean, guess what time of day? At night. You want to know when crime increases? At night. You want to know when sexually illicit activity happens? At night. I mean, all of a sudden, people think that in the darkness, they can do what they wish. Jesus said it this way, men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. Why is it that men love darkness? Because they think they can hide there. But there's no distance that can separate you from God, and there's no darkness that can hide you from God. God sees through the dark. And isn't it interesting that one of the things that Jesus calls himself, he calls himself the light of the world. I mean, when Jesus came into this world, he came to rescue people like you and me from darkness. And actually, when you come to know Jesus, in the book of Colossians, it says this, you're rescued from the kingdom of darkness, and you're transferred into the kingdom of the dear Son of God's love. Why? What's that? It's the kingdom of light. You were once darkness, but now you are light. Walk as children of light, Paul says. I'll tell you something. You cannot buy into the lie that darkness covers you, that darkness hides you, that you can sin in the dark and God doesn't know. He knows. He sees through it just as if it was light. There's no distance that can separate you from God. There's no darkness that can hide you from God. You have a God who is with you incessantly. He's a personal God, and you can't run from him, and you can't hide from him. So God knows you intimately. God goes with you incessantly. But finally in this psalm, it tells us in verses 13 through 18 that God made you individually. Like literally, God made you unique and special. Look at verse number 13. This is all building this case that we have a very personal God. Verse 13, you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. You saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was nothing. There was none of them. God made us unique and special. He formed our inward parts. He knit us together. He skillfully wove us. He knew our presence. Listen, even before your mother knew you existed, God knew you existed. Before that little test had a plus sign on it, God knew that you were there. God knew you. Some people, I think, are struggling these days. And I don't know if you scroll through Facebook, you're seeing this large debate that's going on right now in our culture about when is it that God knows you as a human person? When is it that God really lays his love upon you? I want to tell you something. In this passage, the case is settled. I mean, you actually don't have to go to science class here at the university. You don't have to listen to the opinions of your friends. You need to listen to God. He says this. He says, I saw your unformed substance. Oh, that's just globular glue. That's just fetal tissue. No, it's God seeing your unformed substance. God knows before everything is even formed, God knows you. Is that a human being or is that just a something? No, it's a human. God knows you specifically and uniquely. I mean, friends, I just want to challenge you. If you're wondering about what position do I take with all of the debate that's going on about the sanctity of life, I just want to challenge you with some passages of Scripture, this one included. But you turn to passages like Genesis chapter 25, and you're going to find that God is speaking to Isaac and Rebekah. And he's talking to him, and here's Isaac, and he's praying that his barren wife Rebekah would conceive. And God speaks there and says, you're going to have two sons. And he speaks about those two before they're even born. God knows them. And he talks about the struggle that's going to happen in the womb. He's going to talk about how the younger is going to be greater than the older. He's going to talk about all of that. He's going to talk about their destiny. He's going to talk about that before they're ever birthed. God knows. He refers to to unborn children as children. He gives them personhood. You look at passages like Luke chapter 1, verses 36 through 44, and there you're going to encounter a story about Elizabeth and Mary. Some of you who have read the gospel account in the book of Luke, you know that story, don't you? It's where Elizabeth is perhaps 6 months pregnant. Mary is newly pregnant. And Mary comes, and it says that John the Baptist leaps in the womb. He leaps, he kicks. There's some pregnant women here who know what that kick feels like. I mean, you're getting jabbed or punched inside. John the Baptist leapt inside of Elizabeth's womb when Jesus came. Here's Jesus, I mean, just weeks old. The conception, the immaculate conception of Jesus happened, the miraculous conception happened just weeks before, and here is this baby of John just leaping. And the passage just explains this. Here's God, and he speaks about what's going on here, and Elizabeth blesses Mary, and it's just an amazing passage. You have a two-week-old and a six-month-old, and God is speaking about both of them. You go to Jeremiah chapter 1, the word of the Lord is going to come, and it says to Jeremiah, before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. Before you came forth out of the womb, I set you apart. I ordained you a prophet unto the nations. God had a purpose for Jeremiah before he was ever birthed. I mean, some of these passages, just bring these passages together and answer some of the questions that our culture right now is struggling with. Our unborn children, are they human beings, and should they be treated with the same rights? And the answer to that is yes, because God calls them that. He knows their unformed substance. He knows their frame. He's the one that's weaving them together. I mean, you start thinking about these little ones by 8 weeks old. They have all of their organs. They're beginning to function. Their brain is beginning to work. They have a pumping heart. They have a liver that's making blood cells. Kidneys that are cleaning fluids. By 8 weeks, they have fingerprints. At 8 weeks, ultrasound shows them recoiling from pricking. At 8 weeks, they respond to sound. There's been this Facebook video that's been going around right now. There's a woman, there's an ultrasound. Has anyone seen this one where the parents begin to sing and the baby's clapping? Anyone see that? It's one of the coolest little videos that's going around right now. Here's this little baby. It's an ultrasound, and the baby's just kind of like, it looks just like the baby's clapping to the parents singing. Listen, these little ones are not yet, they're not yet born, but they're special, and they are loved by God, and he is forming them, and they are people in his sight. And that's what you're going to get from verses 13 through 16. God is the one that forms. We can't destroy that. God is the one knitting them together. We can't deny that. We need to praise God for these babies that are being fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, O Lord. Listen, God knew when we were being formed in the secret places. God saw our unformed substance. It says in the end of verse 16, did you see this? It says, all of our days, God knew all of our days before one of them was birthed. I mean, sometimes we wonder, how long am I going to live? I mean, what's the length of this journey of my life? God knows every one of your days, and he knew it before you were born. He knew every single one of them. It is interesting that in our culture, we struggle with the truth of this passage. And yet it's almost like there's this schizophrenia, there's this bipolarity that's happening in our culture. We have 36 states that have fetal homicide laws. And yet in the same states that they allow abortion to take place. And I want you to try to just figure that out. Fetal homicide laws are where if you would kill a mother who's pregnant, you would actually be charged with 2 counts of homicide. Because you've also killed the baby that's in her womb. We have 36 states with fetal homicide laws, and yet those same states you can abort a child. If the unborn are not living human beings, then why do we perform fetal surgery on babies in the womb? It's like we can't figure it out. In the same hospital, we're trying to save this unborn child by doing fetal surgery. In the same hospital, we're destroying their life in another ward. You know, it's a struggle our culture is having, but the Bible makes it very clear that these unborn babies are children that are precious in his sight. God made each person unique and special. And it starts at conception where he begins to weave you together, and he has accounted for all your days even before one of them's born. And I just want to say something about this fact, and that is that there are many people who struggle with their identity, like, and maybe their looks, or maybe just the way that they are, and they struggle with that. Like, why are my teeth crooked? Or why do I have a Czechoslovakian nose? Or, I mean, why did God do this to me? You know, I mean, like, we wonder about some of these things. Why am I the way I am? Well, I wish I was taller. I wish I was shorter. I wish I was thinner. I wish I had a little more beef to me. I wish, and we do these things sometimes about ourselves. We don't understand that God actually made us. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. And that should really impact the way we view ourselves. Like, if you will actually just accept that God made you, you. He didn't make you like this movie star, and he didn't make you like this fashion model. And he didn't make you, he made you, you. And you're fearfully and you're wonderfully made. I mean, this world was not supposed to be this monochromatic cookie cutter series of everybody looks the same. I mean, that's ridiculous. He made us tall and short and thicker and thinner and, I mean, furrier and balder. And I mean, he did all these things for us. We're fearfully and we're wonderfully made. And that affects the way we view ourselves. And I just want to say this, it affects the way we view other people. Like, if you will really receive that God has made people fearfully and wonderfully made, then you will treat them as image bearers. You won't mock them and deride them and make fun of them and demean them. And you won't ostracize them and marginalize them because of things they can't change. That's God fearfully and wonderfully made them. I still remember this little boy. When I was in Texas pastoring a church, this little boy comes in. I call him a little boy because he was short. Even though he was 17 years old, he was much, much smaller than you'd ever imagine a 17-year-old to be. And he was actually born without fingers. He had a gnarled up body. It was twisted and deformed. This guy's name was Colby, and he was one of the nicest kids you'd ever meet. And you can imagine all the faces he received in his life, like what people did when they looked at him and how people responded to him when they first saw him. And just imagine, I mean, your tears come to your eyes about what happened on school playgrounds and for this little guy. But that's the way that God made him. I mean, he's fearfully and wonderfully made. He's a treasure in God's sight. I mean, our youngest in this clump of three here, we have 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, and then we have a gap of five. Well, Cana was in this line of two-year gaps, and Cana was born at the same time that three others were born in our church. There were all these girls born at the same time in our church. I mean, within like 2 weeks. And one of these girls, her name is Ella, and she was born with Down syndrome. And I still remember visiting the hospital, and parents just, I mean, they're trying to like wonder what has God done? What should we do? How should we respond? And I just want to say, this girl, Ella, is a treasure in God's sight. Fearfully, wonderfully made. Listen, some of you wear glasses and you can't see far. Some of you don't have the highest IQ. Some of you may be wishing you had more hair. Some of you wish you were taller. Some of us wish we could be better looking. Some of us wish, I mean, we have all these things, but listen, stop. We're different and we're unique and we're special in God's sight. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. And we need to treasure what God has done. Even sometimes when they come in unique packages, this is the work of God. And that's what the psalmist is doing here. He's actually just overflowing in praise because of what God has done. God knows us. God goes with us. God made us. He made us uniquely, and he made us with a purpose. I think one of the greatest things here in verse number 16 talks about how God knows all of our days. Listen, you don't have to wander through life wondering, what was I made for? What am I supposed to do? Is there any purpose for my... No, God has a purpose for your life. He knows every one of your days before you were ever born. He's got a plan for you. Some people wonder if they're worth living. They should go on living, and if there's anything for them to do, or I don't know, I just don't fit in. Stop, friend. Please listen to the word of the Lord this morning. You are special in his sight. He created you, he made you, and he has a plan for every one of your days. There are people who feel unloved and unappreciated. This last couple years, I worked up at the Air Force Base as a chaplain. I ministered to 11,000 people up there and visited in my office with more than 1,300 of them. who came for counseling. And there were a number of people in the past 2 years who came in wondering if they should go on living. I mean, they despaired of life itself. Some of them had actually attempted to take their own life many times. Some of them had ended up in ICU. I mean, I received a text just this last week while I was in Minnesota from someone who was just struggling with whether they should live or not. I mean, there's people out there, they wonder, do I have any purpose in life? Is there any reason for me to be here? They despair of life itself. And this passage should really comfort the hearts of those folks who are struggling this morning, that God has a purpose for your life. He has a purpose for every day of your life. And he loves you deeply because he's your personal God. He knows your pain. He goes with you, and he made you uniquely and special in his sight. I think when we take all this and we put it together, we're actually impacted by a very personal God. I mean, this isn't like the deistic version of God where he's the watchmaker that winds the clock and steps away and we never hear from God again. No, this is a very personal God. He knows when you get up in the morning, and he knows when you sit down. He knows all the thoughts that go through your mind, and he knows the words that come to your tongue even before they're uttered. He goes with you no matter where you are. He looks at your life, and he says, I know every one of your days, and I have a plan for them, and I made you uniquely. I mean, this is a very personal God, isn't it? And in the end of the psalm, the real question is this. So then how do we respond to this personal God? I mean, what are we supposed to do with a God who knows us, with a God who goes with us, and a God who made us? What are we supposed to do with a God like that? And I think there's really only two things that we can do that are authentic responses to a very personal God. It's in verses 19 through 24. And the first thing you see there, how do we respond to this personal God? Well, we separate from evil. Verses 19 through 22, you hear the psalmist. He says, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Some of you read it, you're like, wow, here's a guy, he's filled with hatred. I mean, wow, whoa. No, do you know what? He's hating what God hates. He's really committing. Here's a God who knows everything. Here's a God who goes with me everywhere. Here's a God who made me. I need to separate from evil. And that's what you see the psalmist praying at the end. He wants a heart that separates from evil. And he wants a heart that submits to God. Look at verses 23 and 24. It's kind of like he just opens himself up. He says, search me, O God, know me. Like, I'm completely submitted to you. Whatever you want, God, you know me, you made me, you go with me wherever I go. So God, I'm submitted. He says, search me, O God, know my heart, try me, know my thoughts. See if there's any grievous way in me and lead me. Notice his submission. He's not trying to go his own way, do his own thing, do what he wants to do. No, he's come to this point of submission where he just says, lead me in the way everlasting. Friends, we have a very personal God this morning. The psalmist says he knows you, he goes with you, he made you. So respond to this personal God by separating from evil and submitting to him. Let's pray and ask for the Lord's help as we seek to do that today.